Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe, Gazette, and Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, November the 17th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Now here's our first story from the Mason City Globe Gazette. It's entitled, Internet Phone Services Collapse. Israel has yet to prove Hamas use hospital as command center. It's written by Wafa Sharafa, Jack Jeffrey, and Lee Keith of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Khan Yunis, Gaza Strip. Internet and television services collapsed across the Gaza Strip on Thursday for lack of fuel, the main Palestinian provider said, bringing a potentially long-term blackout of communications as Israel signaled its offensive against Hamas would next target the south, where most of the population took refuge. For a second day, Israeli troops searched Shifa Hospital in the north for traces of Hamas. They displayed guns they claim were hidden in one building, but have yet to release evidence of a central Hamas command center that Israel says is concealed beneath the complex. Hamas and staff at the hospital, Gaza's largest, deny the allegations. The military claimed it found the body of one of the hostages abducted by Hamas, 65-year-old Yehudit Weiss, in a building adjacent to Shifa, where it was said it also found assault rifles and rocket-propelled grenades. It did not give the causes of her death. The communications breakdown largely cuts off Gaza's 2.3 million people from each other and the outside world, worsening the severe humanitarian crisis in southern Gaza, even as Israeli airstrikes continue there. The UN's World Food Program warned of the immediate possibility of starvation in Gaza as the food supply broke down under Israel's seal, and too little is coming from Egypt. The war was triggered after Hamas's October 7th attack in southern Israel, which left more than 1,200 people dead, according to the Israeli government. Militants also captured some 240 hostages. Israel responded to the attack with a weeks-long air campaign and a ground invasion of northern Gaza, vowing to remove Hamas from power and crush its military capabilities. More than 11,470 Palestinians have been killed, two-thirds of them women and minors, according to Palestinian health authorities. Another 2,700 are reported missing, believed buried under rubble. The official count does not differentiate between civilian and militant deaths. The war inflamed tensions elsewhere. In the occupied West Bank, Palestinian gunmen opened fire at a checkpoint on the main road linking Jerusalem to Israeli settlements, killing a soldier and wounding three people. The three attackers were killed, according to police. Hamas claimed responsibility for the attack. A day after storming into Shifa, Gaza's largest hospital, Israeli troops continued searching the complex. Gaza's health ministry said the troops searched underground levels of the hospital Thursday and detained technicians who run its equipment. The hospital has been without electricity for almost a week, and staff said they are struggling to keep 36 premature babies and 45 dialysis patients alive without functional equipment. One dialysis patient died Thursday, said Shifa's director, Mohammed Abu Salmiya, adding that 650 wounded patients and 5,000 displaced people are in the hospital. Israel said its soldiers brought medical teams with incubators and other supplies, but Shifa staff said incubators were useless without fuel to power generators. During previous days of fighting in the nearby streets, there was no report of Hamas fighters firing from inside Shifa and no fighting when Israeli troops entered Wednesday. Israel faces pressure to prove its claim that Hamas set up its main command center in and under the hospital, which has multiple buildings over an area of several city blocks. On Thursday, the military released video of a hole in the hospital courtyard it said was a tunnel entrance. It also showed several assault rifles and RPGs, grenades, ammunition clips, and utility vests laid out on a blanket that it said were found in a pickup truck in the courtyard. The Associated Press could not independently verify the Israeli claims. The allegations are part of Israel's broader accusation that Hamas uses Palestinians as human shields across the Gaza Strip, which Israeli officials claim is the reason for the large number of civilian casualties during weeks of bombardment. The military says it largely consolidated its efforts of the north through fighting, though fighting continues there. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said Wednesday the ground operation will eventually include both the north and south. We will strike Hamas wherever it is. He did not give a time frame. Israeli forces dropped leaflets Thursday telling Palestinians in areas east of the southern town of Khan Yunis to evacuate. Similar leaflets were dropped over northern Gaza for weeks ahead of the ground invasion. Strikes continued in the south Thursday. In the city of Deir al-Bala, a funeral was held for 28 people killed in an overnight bomb that leveled several buildings. Most of Gaza's population is crowded into southern Gaza, including hundreds of thousands who heeded Israel's call to leave the north to get out of the way of its ground offensive. Some 1.5 million people driven from their homes are packed into UN shelters or houses with other families. If the assault moves into the south, it is not clear where they would go, as Egypt refuses to allow a mass transfer onto its soil. The Israeli military has called on people to move to a safe zone in Mawasi, a town on the Mediterranean coast a few square miles in size, where humanitarian aid could be delivered. Our next story is entitled, Education Department Says College Alliances for Transfers Boost Grad Rates. It's written by Carolyn Thompson of the Associated Press. After delaying college for 2 years because of the COVID-19 pandemic, Jaden Todd wasn't sure a four-year school was the right place to start. I was extremely concerned that I forgot how to learn, he said. Community college appealed as a stepping stone, but he also had heard stories of students who had to start over when they transferred because their credits didn't count at the new school. Todd, age 21, was relieved to wind up at Northern Virginia Community College's Advance program, a partnership with George Mason University that put him on a clear path to his goal of a bachelor's degree in computer science. Such established arrangements between 2- and 4-year colleges and universities have shown promise in helping more community college students go on to earn bachelor's degrees, according to data released Thursday by U.S. Education Department. Only 13% of federal financial aid recipients who enrolled in community college in the year 2014 received a bachelor's degree within 8 years, the data found. Hundreds of thousands of those who enroll annually at the more affordable 2-year schools plan to transfer to a 4-year program at a college or university, but obstacles get in the way. Frequently, students lack the guidance they need to navigate the transfer, and their credits don't transfer the way they planned. Our current higher education system stacks the deck against community college students who aspire to earn 4-year degrees, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said ahead of a gathering of 200 higher education leaders convened Thursday by his department to examine state and school transfer policies. The new data tracked roughly 620,000 federal financial aid recipients. The outcomes are especially concerning for Black, Hispanic, and low-income students who are more likely to start at community colleges. Colleges in New Jersey, New York, and Illinois graduated the most transfer students, with schools in South Dakota, Delaware, Indiana, and New Mexico recording the lowest numbers. One of the things that I think has really played a pivotal role in transfer student success is our goal to make as much information transparent, said Alicia Alvaro, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic and Faculty Affairs at the City University of New York. CUNY relies on an online transfer explorer known as T-Rex that makes it easier for students to see which of their courses will transfer between campuses, Alvaro said. The State University of New York is experimenting with artificial intelligence to let students map courses between any of the community and 4-year campuses in the system, said Dan Knox, a director of the National Association of System Heads, an organization of 48 public higher education systems across the country formed to advance innovation in higher education. At SUNY, that's 30 community colleges and 64 campuses in total, so the choice sets in a system that large for students are just overwhelming, Knox said. It's just tough to map all those out manually, he said. The Education Department data also found widely varying results when it looked at pairings between 2 and 4 year institutions in each state to evaluate how often community college students graduated from 4 year institutions they would most likely attend. Among the highest performing pairs were those with established partnerships designed to ease the transfer process, like the one at George Mason. Todd, a 2020 high school graduate in Woodbridge, Virginia, said he liked that the co-enrollment program set from the start the classes he would take in community college and at George Mason. He'd heard of others paying thousands for tuition only to lose credits and find themselves behind when they transferred. "I mean, I could spend $15,000 a year and want to try another college out," he said. Researchers said evaluating why certain pairings do better than others would help improve transfer systems as a whole. The findings are expected to guide higher education leaders who are struggling with declining enrollment and students concerned about adding to the $1.77 trillion in student debt loan debt. "We have never before had national data that looked at how well students do when they move among colleges and universities," says James Caval, Undersecretary of Education. "So this study we've done, looking at people who get student aid, is really groundbreaking and has shed new light onto the role that both community colleges and four-year colleges play in helping their students get that college degree." Sickle cell therapy approved in Britain. This is written by Maria Cheng of the Associated Press, and the dateline is London. Britain's medicines regulator authorized the world's first gene therapy treatment for sickle cell disease in a move that could offer relief to thousands of people with the crippling disease in the UK. In a statement Thursday, the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency said it approved Casgevy, the first medicine licensed using the gene editing tool CRISPR, which won its makers a Nobel Prize in the year 2020. The agency approved the treatment for patients with sickle cell disease and thalassemia who are 12 years old and older. Casgevy is made by Vertex Pharmaceuticals Limited and CRISPR Therapeutics. To date, bone marrow transplants, extremely arduous procedures that come with very unpleasant side effects, have been the only long-lasting treatment. "The future of life-changing cures resides in CRISPR based technology," said Dr. Helen O'Neill of University College London. "The use of the word cure in relation to sickle cell disease or thalassemia has up until now been incompatible," she said in a statement calling the MHRA's approval of gene therapy a positive moment in history. "Both sickle cell disease and thalassemia are caused by mistakes in the genes that carry hemoglobin, the protein in red blood cells that carries oxygen. In people with sickle cell, which is particularly common in people with African or Caribbean backgrounds, a genetic mutation causes the cells to become crescent-shaped, which can block blood flow and cause excruciating pain, organ damage, stroke, and other problems. In people with thalassemia, the genetic mutation can cause severe anemia. Patients typically require blood transfusions every few weeks and injections and medicines for their entire life. Thalassemia predominantly affects people of Southeast Asian, and Middle Eastern heritage. The new medicine, Casgevy, works by targeting the problematic gene in a patient's bone marrow stem cells so that the body can make properly function hemoglobin. Patients first receive a course of chemotherapy before doctors take stem cells from the patient's bone marrow and use genetic editing techniques in a laboratory to fix the gene. The cells are then infused back into the patient for a permanent treatment. Patients must be hospitalized at least twice, once for the collection of the stem cells and then to receive the altered cells. "This is so exciting. It's a new wave of treatments that we can utilize for patients with sickle cell disease," said Dr. James LaBelle, director of the Pediatric Stem Cell and Cellular Therapy Program at University of Chicago. He said Britain's approval suggested the U.S. authorization was likely imminent. Casgevy is currently being reviewed by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The agency is expected to make a decision early next month before considering another sickle cell gene therapy. LaBelle said officials at the University of Chicago are already moving forward to build not only the clinical infrastructure, but also the reimbursement infrastructure to get these patients this treatment. Britain's regulator said its decision to authorize the gene therapy for sickle cell disease was based on a study done on 29 patients, of whom 28 reported having no severe pain problems for at least 1 year after being treated. In the study for thalassemia, 39 out of 42 patients who got the therapy did not need a red blood cell transfusion for at least a year afterwards. Gene therapy treatments can cost millions of dollars, and experts have previously raised concerns that they could remain out of reach for most people who would benefit most. Last year, Britain approved a gene therapy for a fatal genetic disorder that had a list price of $3.5 million. England's National Health Service negotiated a significant confidential discount to make it available to eligible patients. Vertex Pharmaceuticals said it had not yet established a price for the treatment in Britain and was working with health authorities to secure reimbursement and access for eligible patients as quickly as possible. In the U.S., Vertex has not released a potential price for the therapy, but a report by the nonprofit Institute for Clinical and Economic Review said prices up to about $2 million would be cost-effective. By comparison, research this year showed medical expenses for current sickle cell treatments from birth to age 65 add up to about $1.6 million for women and $1.7 million for men. Medicines and treatments in Britain must be recommended by a government watchdog before they are made freely available to patients in the national healthcare system. Millions of people around the world, including about 100,000 in the U.S., have sickle cell disease. It occurs more often among people from places where malaria is or was common, like Africa and India, and is also more common in certain ethnic groups, such as people of African, Middle Eastern, and Indian descent. Scientists believe being a carrier of the sickle cell trait helps protect against severe malaria. Jury convicts assailant. DePape could face up to 50 years in prison when he is sentenced. This is written by Olga R. Rodriguez of the Associated Press, and the dateline is San Francisco. A jury on Thursday convicted the man who broke into former U.S. Speaker Nancy Pelosi's San Francisco home last year of federal charges for seeking to hold her hostage and attacking her husband with a hammer. Jurors deliberated for about 8 hours before finding David DePape guilty of attempted kidnapping of a federal official and assault on the immediate family member of a federal official. He faces up to 50 years in prison when he's sentenced. The attack on then 82-year-old Paul Pelosi was captured on police body camera video just days before the midterm elections. DePape, age 43, admitted during trial testimony that he broke into the Pelosi's home on October the 28th, 2022, intending to hold Nancy Pelosi hostage and break her kneecaps if she lied to him. He also admitted it to bludgeoning Paul Pelosi with a hammer after San Francisco police officers showed up at the home, saying his plan to end what he viewed as government corruption was unraveling. Defense attorneys argued that DePape was motivated by his political beliefs, not because he wanted to interfere with Nancy Pelosi's official duties as a member of Congress, making the charges against him invalid. A sentencing date has not yet been set. A status hearing is scheduled for December the 13th. DePape, a Canadian citizen who moved to the U.S. more than 20 years ago, also is charged in state court with assault with a deadly weapon, elder abuse, residential burglary, and other felonies. A state trial date will be set during a November 29th hearing, San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins said. She said her office will confer with federal prosecutors and the Pelosis to determine next steps. During his testimony, DePape echoed right-wing conspiracy theories and told jurors he planned to wear an inflatable unicorn costume and record his interrogation of Nancy Pelosi to upload it online. Prosecutors say he had rope and zip ties with him. DePape told jurors he believed news outlets repeatedly lied about former President Donald Trump. In rants posted on a blog and online forum that were taken down after his arrest, DePape echoed the baseless right-wing QAnon conspiracy theory that claims the U.S. government is run by a cabal of devil-worshipping pedophiles. He repeated QAnon-like conspiracies during his testimony, referring to a cabal and the ruling elite and saying they are eroding Americans' liberty and allowing the abuse of children. GM workers vote to approve union contract. Company becomes first Detroit automaker to seal an agreement. This comes from the Associated Press, and the dateline is Detroit. United Auto Workers Union members voted to approve a new contract with General Motors, making the company the first Detroit automaker to get a ratified deal that could end a contentious labor dispute in a series of crippling strikes. A vote tracking spreadsheet on the union's website showed that with all local union offices reporting, the contract passed by just over 3,400 votes with 54.7% in favor. A union spokesman on Thursday confirmed the spreadsheet had the official GM totals. The outcome was closer than expected after the UAW's celebrations of victories last month on many key demands that led to 6 weeks of targeted walkouts against GM, Ford, and Stellantis, the maker of Jeep and Ram vehicles. The contract had a big lead Thursday in voting at Ford and Stellantis. Ratification was leading at Ford by more than 10,000 votes, with 66% of ballots in favor. At Stellantis, the lead was more than 5,700, with 66.5% voting for the deal, according to the UAW website. Voting continues at Ford through early Saturday. At Stellantis, tallies are expected to be complete by Tuesday. House Ethics Committee condemns Representative Santos. Lawmaker says he won't run again after accusations of lying. This also comes from the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. The House Ethics Committee said Thursday it amassed overwhelming evidence of lawbreaking by Republican Representative George Santos of New York that was sent to the Justice Department, concluding flatly that he cannot be trusted after a months-long investigation into his conduct. On social media, Santos blasted the report as a disgusting, politicized smear, but said he would not seek re-election to a second term. He gave no indication, however, that he would step aside before his term ends, vowing to pursue his conservative values in my remaining time in Congress. But a renewed effort to expel him from the House was quickly launched. The House would vote on his expulsion as soon as it returns from the Thanksgiving holiday this month. The panel said Santos knowingly caused his campaign committee to file false or incomplete reports with the Federal Election Commission, use campaign funds for personal purposes, and violated the Ethics in Government Act concerning financial disclosure statements. The report also detailed Santos's lack of cooperation with its investigation. In sports, the Baltimore Ravens defeated the Cincinnati Bengals 34-20 last night. Lamar Jackson threw two touchdown passes in the second quarter, one of which came thanks to a fortuitous carom, and the Baltimore Ravens beat Cincinnati 34-20 on Thursday night after the Bengals lost star quarterback Joe Burrow to a wrist injury. In other NFL news, Diggs reiterates commitment to Buffalo Bills. Trayvon Diggs didn't do his older brother any favors. A tumultuous week in Buffalo in which the Bills lost because of a too-many-men penalty and fired their offensive coordinator continued on Thursday when receiver Stephon Diggs took exception to having to reiterate his commitment to the team. "I've never been nothing but fully invested," Diggs said. "I feel like I addressed it in training camp, but here we are again." Diggs was put on the spot courtesy of his younger brother, the sidelined Dallas Cowboys cornerback, who posted messages on social media following Buffalo's loss to the Denver Broncos on Monday. "Man, 14 gotta get up out of there," Trayvon Diggs wrote in reference to Stephon Diggs' number 14. Stephon Diggs responded by saying he loves his brother and whatever discussions he might have about the posts will be kept in-house. From the Pittsburgh Steelers, Pittsburgh special teams coordinator Danny Smith says he tore the rotator cuff in his right shoulder off the bone in three places when Steelers safety DeMonte Kazi plowed over him on the sideline at the end of Kazi's game-clinching interception return in last Sunday's victory over Green Bay. From the Miami Dolphins, Miami released veteran wide receiver Robbie Chosen, the team announced Thursday. Chosen signed with Miami as a free agent in April, was released as part of roster cuts in August, and later re-signed to the practice squad. He appeared in four games for the Dolphins. And from the Green Bay Packers, offensive tackle Brian Bulaga plans to retire from the NFL with the Green Bay Packers after spending the first 10 seasons of his career with them. Packers general manager Brian Gutekunst announced Thursday that Bulaga let the team know about his intent to retire as a Packer. Bulaga hasn't played in the NFL since appearing in one game with the Los Angeles Chargers in the year 2021. From the MLB, Ohtani is first to win two unanimous American League MVPs. Braves Acuña Jr. wins unanimous National League MVP. Shohei Ohtani, who has captivated baseball with his unprecedented combination of high-level hitting and premium pitching, became the first two-time unanimous Most Valuable Player when he won the American League honor on Thursday. Ohtani, a free agent after finishing his contract with the Los Angeles Angels, received all 30 first-place votes and 420 points in voting by the Baseball Writers Association of America. He was a unanimous MVP in 2021 and finished second to the Yankees' Aaron Judge in voting last year. This was just the 20th unanimous MVP vote since the award was established in 1931. Corey Seager was second with 24 second-place votes and 264 points, and Texas teammate Marcus Semien was third with 5 second-place votes and 216 points. Balloting took place before the postseason when the Rangers won their first World Series title. And Ronald Acuña Jr. was a unanimous winner of his first National League Most Valuable Player award after becoming the first big leaguer with 40 homers and 70 stolen bases in a season. Acuña, a right fielder for the Atlanta Braves, received all 30 first-place votes and 420 points in voting by the Baseball Writers Association of America. Mookie Betts received all 30 second-place votes and 270 points, followed by Los Angeles Dodgers teammate Freddie Freeman with 227 points. Betts earned the 2018 AL MVP award with Boston, and Freeman was the 2020 NL MVP with the Dodgers. Here's some scores from the National Hockey League. The Golden Knights beat Montreal 6-5 on Thursday night. The Senators 5, Red Wings 4 in overtime. Coyotes 3, Blue Jackets 2. The Devils defeated the Penguins 5-2. Lightning beat the Blackhawks 4-2. The Flames 5, Canucks 2. And Kraken 4, Islanders 3. In sudden overtime. Also from the NHL, Blackhawks weigh in on player death. Chicago Blackhawks defenseman Connor Murphy can't bring himself to watch the video of former NHL player Adam Johnson's fatal neck injury during an English League hockey game last month. "I never saw the video because I didn't want to watch it, to be honest," Murphy said. "I didn't want that image in my mind. It's so horrific, and I just think about his family and him." But he did hear the news that police in England arrested a man Tuesday on suspicion of manslaughter. The suspect was released on bail Wednesday. The man South Yorkshire police arrested has not been identified publicly. Footage from the October 28th game establishes that Sheffield Steelers player Matt Petgrave's leg kicked up after a collision with one of Johnson's Nottingham Panthers teammates, and Petgrave's skate blade cut Johnson's neck. Johnson, a former Pittsburgh Penguins forward, later died at the hospital. He was 29 years old. In the immediate aftermath of the incident, the Panthers called it a freak accident in a statement. Since then, police in the hockey community have wrestled with reading into the intent of Petgrave's actions, whether it was accidental, part of a fast-paced hockey play, or a reckless play that rises to criminality. "I can't say anything on it," Murphy said. Added fourth-liner Boris Kautchuk, "I really don't know the answer." You are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print handicapped. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we'll turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger. top story on the front page of the Messenger today is entitled Remembering Olden Days, Elementary Students Travel Back in Time to Learn Iowa Ag History. It's written by Darcy Doherty Malsby of the Messenger, and the dateline is Humboldt. Second grade students at Taft Elementary School and first grade students at St. Mary Catholic School recently traveled back in time to discover the history of farming as part of their ag in the classroom lessons. Colleen Birdie, a Tri-County Ag in the Classroom Coordinator for Farm Bureau, and Kirsten Gatewood, Youth Coordinator for Humboldt County ISU Extension and Outreach, used a PowerPoint presentation and hands-on learning to bring farming to life from the first settlers to modern-day agriculture. The lesson began with a brief history of North America and stories of the Native Americans who started farming the land 10,000-plus years ago by growing maize. Students learned that their ancestors moved to North America in hope of a better life and were taught how to grow corn by the Native Americans by planting the seeds with a piece of fish. The students discovered that the Homestead Act in the mid-1800s encouraged many settlers to move west. Photos of a covered wagon, log cabin, hand-powered corn planter, and a plow and planter pulled by horses helped students understand that farming demanded hard physical work with every member of the family helping. Students learned that Iowa farms started out small with only enough crops and livestock to feed the family and the livestock. Presenters shared photos to show how advances in technology, including tractors, help farmers grow more crops in less time. Farming has become so efficient that it's possible for one farm today to feed 166 people a year. While farmers use combines to harvest crops today, presenters explained how farmers in years past used to have to harvest corn by hand. They demonstrated this with a vintage corn husking glove and a stalk of corn. They explained how each ear of corn would have been picked and husked by hand. Students received an ear of corn and were encouraged to remove a few kernels so they could learn how it felt to shell corn by hand. The students also had the opportunity to finish shelling their ear of corn with a vintage hand-cranked corn sheller. They quickly learned that shelling the corn took time and was hard work. They also broke the cobs in half to see the inside. The students were extremely excited to take their shelled corn home, Birdie said. An antique handheld corn planter also offered a unique hands-on learning experience for the students. The kids quickly learned how to open and close the wooden handle so the seeds would fall accurately from the planter box to a bucket, which was used in place of soil in this classroom lesson. While the farm children had plenty of chores on the farm, education was important to many families. In the early 1900s, Iowa had about 12,000 country schools, which were located every 2 miles. Presenters explained that children of the early settlers walked or rode their horse to a one-room schoolhouse where all the grades were taught by one teacher. They also noted that many country schools did not have electricity. Students were surprised to learn that most farm children, especially boys, did not attend school after 8th grade because they were needed to work on the farm. I also felt it was important for the students to understand how farm families made simple toys and games from materials available on the farm, Birdie said. A vine could be used as a jump rope, for example. Hiding the buttons was a great game any time of the year. Birdie made a family of corn husk dolls to help show how something as simple and common as corn husks could be used for toys. She donated one of the dolls for the class to keep on display. Presenters also showed the kids a replica of a vintage ball and cup game and explained how the father would have made this game from wood. Before the lesson ended, every student received a ball and cup game that Gail Wood made from supplies in her home, just like the early settlers used readily available materials to make games and toys. The kids improved their hand-eye coordination as they played with the toys and learned how to flip the ball into the paper cup. This ag history lesson provided a great opportunity for students to gain an understanding of how difficult farm life was for early Americans and how advancements in technology continually improve agriculture and all our lives, Birdie said. Thank you to all the school students and educators for allowing us to visit your classrooms, she added. Birdie also thanked Humboldt area farmer Mike Ludwig for providing the ears of corn for the ag history lessons. Next is an article entitled Knowledge is Key in Fighting Against Opioid Abuse. CFR offers several programs locally. It's written by Bill Shea. For those concerned about all the havoc that opioid abuse could cause for them and their loved ones, one local organization offers help through education. Community and Family Resources provides classes that give kids the mental tools to make good decisions, including the decision to say no thanks to alcohol and drugs. And it offers classes that teach people how to administer a life-saving dose of Narcan, the drug that can reverse an opioid overdose. Anybody we can get to these trainings, that's beneficial, said Mickey Steuben, prevention supervisor for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Organization that serves seven area counties. The prevention training sessions offered by the group, often called CFR, are evidence-based programs taught to people of all ages. They include drug overdose training and primary prevention strategies to address opioid use. But the biggest and most popular community training program, according to Steuben, is the one that teaches citizens how to administer Narcan to save an overdose victim. Narcan is a drug that counteracts the effects of opioids, essentially by replacing the opioids in the pain receptors of the brain. It is administered by spraying it into a person's nose. Steuben said those who complete the class receive a voucher that can be taken to Daniel Pharmacy, 1114 Central Avenue, to get a free box of Narcan that contains two doses. She said Narcan is just a good, preventative, harm reduction medication to have around. She said that in fiscal year 2023, CFR has trained 391 people and the majority of them took the Narcan class. For students, CFR has at least two programs tailored to helping them reject the lure of alcohol and drugs. For sixth graders, there is the All-Stars program. It aims to prevent underage drinking by helping young people make good decisions. Seventh graders at Fort Dodge Middle School and St. Edmund Catholic School complete CFR's Life Skills program. Steuben said that in an overall good decision-making curriculum, it consists of 15 lessons. She said the class helps the students know how to say no. Feenstra leads Farm Mental Health Bill. It includes $15 million in funding. This is also written by Bill Shea of The Messenger. Federal investment in a mental health program for farmers would increase to $15 million a year for 5 years under a measure recently introduced by U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra. The bill introduced by the Republican from Hull would do these three things: reauthorize the Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance Network, increase its funding by $15 million annually for the next 5 years, and allow the program's regional centers to establish referral connections with certified community behavioral health clinics, critical access hospitals, and rural health centers. The bill is called the Farmers First Act. Farming can be a lonely endeavor, and it can also be a stressful industry when the economy takes a turn for the worse, tornadoes and derechos devastate farmland, and animal disease infect flocks and livestock, all of which can impact the well-being of our producers, Feenstra said in a written statement. He said he was proud to lead legislation to expand behavioral health resources for our rural communities and connect our farmers with medical professionals who can provide the care that our producers deserve. Representatives Mike Boast, a Republican from Illinois, Jim Costa, a Democrat from California, Angie Craig, a Democrat from Minnesota, and Zach Nunn, a Republican from Iowa, are co-sponsoring the legislation. A group of 27 agricultural and mental health organizations have declared their support for the bill. The measure awaits action by committees in the U.S. House of Representatives. New York judge lifts gag order that barred Donald Trump from maligning court staff. A gag order that barred Donald Trump from commenting about court personnel after he disparaged a law clerk in his New York civil fraud trial was temporarily lifted Thursday by an appellate judge who raised free speech concerns. Judge David Friedman of the state's Intermediate Appeals Court issued what's known as a stay, suspending the gag order and allowing the former president to freely comment about court staff while a longer appeals process plays out. The trial judge, Arthur Engoron, imposed the gag order on October the 3rd after Trump made a false comment about the judge's law clerk on social media. He later fined Trump $15,000 for violations and expanded it to his lawyers after they questioned the clerk's prominent role in the trial. Ruling at an emergency hearing Thursday, Friedman questioned Erdogan's authority to police Trump's speech outside the courtroom, such as his frequent gripes about the case on social media and in comments to TV cameras in the courthouse hallway. Friedman said that while it's true that judges often issue gag orders, they're mostly used in criminal cases where there's a fear that comments about the case could influence the jury. Trump's civil trial doesn't have a jury. Take heart, it looks like China could send new pandas to the U.S. This comes from San Francisco. Chinese President Xi Jinping signaled that China will send new pandas to the United States, calling them envoys of friendship between the Chinese and American peoples. We are ready to continue our cooperation with the United States on panda conservation and do our best to meet the wishes of the Californians so as to deepen the friendly ties between our two peoples, Xi said Wednesday during a dinner speech with business leaders. The gesture came at the end of a day in which Xi and President Joe Biden held their first face-to-face meeting in a year and pledged to try to reduce tensions. Xi did not share additional details on when or where pandas might be provided, but appeared to suggest the next pair of pandas are most likely to come to California, probably San Diego. The bears have long been the symbol of the U.S.-China friendship since Beijing gifted a pair of pandas to the National Zoo in Washington in the year 1972, ahead of the normalization of bilateral relations. Later, Beijing loaned the pandas to other U.S. zoos, with proceeds going back to panda conservation programs. The National Zoo's three giant pandas, Mei Zheng, Tian Tian, and their cub, Zhao Kui Ji, 8 days ago began their long trip to China. After their departure, only four pandas are left in the United States in the Atlanta Zoo. I was told that many American people, especially children, were really reluctant to say goodbye to the pandas and went to the zoo to see them off, Xi said in his speech. He added that he learned the San Diego Zoo and people in California very much look forward to welcoming pandas back. Xi is in California to attend a summit of Indo-Pacific leaders and for his meeting with Biden. He made no mention of the pandas during his public remarks earlier in the days as he met with Biden. When bilateral relations began to sour in the past few years, members of the Chinese public started to demand the return of giant pandas. Unproven allegations that U.S. zoos mistreated the pandas, known as China's national treasure, flooded China's social media. But relations showed signs of stabilization as Xi traveled to San Francisco to meet with Biden. The two men met for about 4 hours Wednesday at the picturesque Filoli Historic House and Garden, where they agreed to cooperate on anti-narcotics, resume high-level military communications, and expand people-to-people exchanges. Barefoot workers and cracked floors were found at a factory that made recalled eye drops, FDA says. This comes from Washington. An Indian company that recently recalled eye drops sold in the U.S. had a host of sanitation and manufacturing problems, including barefoot workers, cracked floors, and altered records, U.S. health inspectors found. Food and Drug Administration officials uncovered more than a dozen problems at the Mumbai plant operated by Kilich Healthcare India, according to a preliminary inspection report posted by the agency. The factory produced more than two dozen varieties of eye drops that were subject to an FDA safety warning last month. The products were sold by CVS Health, Target, Rite Aid, and other national retailers who said they would be removed from store shelves. New details about the plant's problems emerged after FDA inspectors visited the plant late last month. Agency inspectors documented factory workers not wearing masks, gloves, and gowns and working barefoot in areas that are supposed to be sterile. A manager told FDA officials that this is their standard practice, according to the report. Elsewhere, FDA staff noted cracked floors, plus water stains and peeling paint on walls and ceilings. The FDA report also suggests factory officials would routinely omit or falsify contamination test results. For instance, a factory microbiologist said that a bacterial sample that could trigger an alert or action limit would not be documented. Instead, officials would perform additional cleaning and then record a figure that indicated sterility. This occurred two or three times per month, according to the microbiologist. The FDA's initial findings are likely to be followed by a formal report and a warning letter to the company. On Monday, Kilich Healthcare officially recalled the lubricating eye drops sold in 27 different brands and formulations. The agency published the notice to its website Wednesday. In economic news, Wall Street drifts amid worries about profits and hopes for a just right economy. Stocks drifted to a mixed finish Thursday as Wall Street's momentum slowed following its hot first half of November. The S&P 500 edged up by 5.36 points or 0.1% to 4,508 and remains comfortably on track for its third straight winning week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped 45.74 or 0.1% to 34,945, and the NASDAQ Composite gained 9.84 or 0.1% to 14,113. Walmart weighed on the stock market with an 8.1% drop after it warned that shoppers began pulling back on spending late last month. The nation's largest retailer also gave a forecast for upcoming holiday profit that was weaker than analysts expected despite topping forecasts for results in its latest quarter. Cisco Systems tumbled 9.8% even though it also reported stronger results for the latest quarter than analysts estimated. The company saw a slowdown of new product orders last quarter, and it gave forecasts for earnings this upcoming quarter and fiscal year that were weaker than analysts expected. Stocks in the oil and gas industry were particularly weak after the price of crude tumbled sharply to its lowest since July. Marathon Petroleum dropped 3.5% and Halliburton fell 3.3%. November, nevertheless, remains on track to be the S&P 500's best month in a year on rising hopes for a Goldilocks economy that's just right for markets. Investors are betting inflation is cooling enough to convince the Federal Reserve to halt its hikes to interest rates following its full fusillade since last year. That, in turn, has pushed expectations up for when the Fed could begin cutting rates, which can act like steroids for financial markets. Several more reports on Thursday indicated a slowing economy. While the weaker-than-expected data are, of course, a signal the economy may be losing some of its strong momentum for investors, they just as importantly may be showing that upward pressures on inflation is easing. One report said that slightly more workers applied for unemployment benefits last week. The number is still low relative to history, but a softening in the job market could prevent the two strong raises in workers' pay that the Fed fears could trigger a vicious cycle, keeping inflation high. Separate reports said that manufacturing in the Mid-Atlantic region is unexpectedly weakening, while U.S. industrial production weakened more than expected in October. The Fed has been trying to shepherd the economy along a tightrope to slow just enough to stamp out high inflation without falling into a recession. Thursday's weaker-than-expected reports strengthened investors' hopes that the Fed can pull it off and go easier on interest rates. That triggered an immediate drop in Treasury yields. The yield on the 10-year Treasury fell to 4.44% from 4.54% late Wednesday. Just last month, it was above 5% as its highest level since the year 2007 and raising worries on Wall Street as it undercut prices for stocks and other investments. Now we'll move on to sports, and the top story is entitled Golden Championship. Bishop Garrigan clinches second state crown in school history. It's written by Dana Becker. The improbable dream for Bishop Garrigan came to fruition here Thursday morning inside the Unidome. Tate Forch accounted for three touchdowns as the unranked and unheralded Golden Bears pulled off one more upset, knocking off number 2 Bedford 39-30 to claim the 8-player state championship. For Bishop Garrigan, this is the second state title in school history and the first for longtime head coach Marty Waddle. The Golden Bears topped four straight teams that were unbeaten entering the game, including both of the most recent state champs. "We like to run the football and we like to go run the power game," Waddle said. "I thought our offensive line once again did a great job with that." Forch, a sophomore, completed 7 of 10 for 109 yards with TD passes to Justin Bauer and Drew Lappy, adding 82 yards and a score with his legs. Senior Caden Rothler rushed for 106 yards and a score, with Ethan Marso adding a rushing touchdown. This group of seniors bought in and they didn't waver, Waddle said. They kept working hard and pulled everyone else right along with them. For all the kids that played in 99, 05, and 16 that were close and didn't win a state title, I told these kids this is absolutely for them too. We were playing for them. Howard retires as Lynx coach. Football career ends after 47 years, 17 at WC. This is written by Eric Pratt. Bob Howard, a Hall of Fame football coach with nearly five decades of memories and accomplishments, rivaled by very few in the history of Iowa, is retiring at Webster City High School, some 40 miles away from where it all began. WCHS Activities Director Jess Howard confirmed Howard's decision on Wednesday evening. Howard told his players earlier in the week that he was ending a 47-year career on the sidelines, with the last 17 coming as the leader of the Lynx. Bob Howard has been a constant force in Webster City for the past 17 football seasons, molding not only football players but all athletes that have walked the halls at WCHS, Jess Howard said. He has taught our athletes how to succeed not only on the gridiron but in life. He has turned the young men that suit up for the opportunity to run out to the bells on Friday nights in the fall into dedicated, loyal, and determined men that understand the sacrifice, effort, and glory of success. Bob came to Webster City and changed a culture in athletics by being the example of what he expects his athletes to be. He has spent countless hours watching game film, drawing plays, and refining his art to be the best coach and advisor to his athletes. His years of experience within the field allowed for him to be a mentor to many Lynx coaches, of which many still refer to when dealing with situations, developing game plans, and teaching mental toughness to their athletes. The 70-year-old Howard turned the Webster City program into a perennial contender again. The former Madrid High School standout player returned to a school not far from his old stomping grounds after winning three state championships and reaching the playoffs 16 times while at Sigourney, Kyoto. Howard, who also coached at Scranton early in his career, took over the reins of the Lynx in 2007, just as Webster City postseason dry spell had reached a full decade. In the next 17 season, Webster City reached the playoffs 14 times, including the Class 3A championship round in 2016. In the last 4 years alone, the Lynx went 31-11 overall and advanced to the quarterfinal round three times. Howard's 372 wins all-time ranks in the state's top five for a career. His retirement will be felt by many more than just the patrons of Webster City, as his career in coaching has led him to be an expert of his art, Jess Howard said. Bob has taught us all how to block out the noise, to perform at our best, and we are lucky to have been a part of his coaching career. Lynx Athletics has reaped the benefits of having Bob Howard at the helm of the football program. Here's a rundown of some of the sports that can be seen on television today. In men's college basketball at 2:30 p.m. on CBS Sports Network, it's Georgia versus Miami. At 5 p.m. on the ACC Network, it's Bucknell at Duke. Also at 5 p.m. on the CBS Network Sports Network, it's Kansas State versus Providence. At 5:30 p.m. on FS1, it's Butler at Michigan. 6 p.m. on Peacock, it's Moorhead at Penn State. 6 p.m. on SEC Network, Florida State at Florida. ACC Network, 7 p.m., UC Riverside at North Carolina. 7:30 p.m. on FS1, it's Maryland at Villanova. 8 p.m. on CBSSN, it's Grand Canyon versus San Francisco. Also at 8 p.m. on the Pac-12 Network, it's Tennessee State at Oregon. At 10 p.m. on the Pac-12 Network, it's Belmont at Arizona. On the CBS Sports Network at 10:30 p.m., it's DePaul versus South Carolina. And at 11 p.m. on ESPN2, it's Washington versus Xavier. In women's college basketball, at 1:30 p.m. on the Pac-12 Network, it's Princeton at UCLA. College football, 8 p.m. on ESPN2 is South Florida at UTSA, and at 9:30 p.m. on FS1, it's Colorado at Washington. In the NBA at 6:40 p.m. on ESPN, you can see Sacramento at San Antonio. And also on ESPN at 9 p.m., it's Phoenix at Utah. In the National Hockey League at 1 p.m. on the National Hockey League Network, you can see Toronto at Detroit. Tritons roll past Iowa Lakes. Iowa Central head coach Luke Moffitt returned to his hometown of Estherville with his 11th-ranked Triton wrestling team on Wednesday. The Tritons, with a record of 2-0 overall, beat Iowa Lakes 44-8. Iowa Central won 7 matches, all by bonus points. Defending national champion Matt Sarbo at 149, Mikey Miller at 165, Tristan Irvin at 184, and Pocahontas area graduate Joseph Sanders, heavyweight, all won by fall. Trenton Walker at 125 pounds and Lawrence Rosario at 174 pounds picked up technical fall victories. Cooper Carlson, 197-pounder, won by forfeit. "We won every match by bonus points," said Iowa Central head coach Luke Moffitt. "It was short and sweet, and we were pretty happy on the night." Joseph got a nice fall to finish off the duel. There was a lot of action in the first period. And also in wrestling, the Fort Dodge Middle School boys wrestling team won 52 of 74 matches against Ames on Thursday. Cadence Kisler and Caden Nichols prevailed 3 times for the Dodgers. 2-time winners included Cale Adams, Memphis Donahue, Drake Hayes, Brexton Hines, Fernando Ortega, Reggie Peterson, Brock Trexler, Michael Benedict, Axel Contreras, Carnero, Riley Klein, John Lochner, and Jose Perez. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.